Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, and I'm joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Rand Paul, Libertarianism and Classical Liberalism. Richard, your piece this week for Defining Ideas is about the fact that, thanks primarily to Senator Rand Paul, libertarianism today kind of has a new purchase in the broader conversation about American politics. But as you're quick to note at the start of the column, that means that we have to define our terms. So the name of this podcast, as well as your column, is The Libertarian. But you write it Defining Ideas. I'm quoting you here. Libertarians fall into two distinct groups, strict libertarians like Rand Paul and classical liberals such as myself. Now, a lot of people use those two terms interchangeably, so we'll get into the specifics in a moment. But at a broader conceptual level, why is it wrong to conflate the two?
Well, the basic distinction between the two principles runs as follows. A strict libertarian thinks that there are only two major obligations that are imposed upon any person. One of them is the obligation to refrain from the use of force, and the other is the obligation to keep your promises when made by contract. Now, both libertarians and non-libertarians accept these propositions. They don't accept the only part of it, but they accept the fact that these things are both important. And both libertarians and non-libertarians understand that it takes a good deal of work to figure out exactly what it means to talk about aggression, because you have to distinguish cases involving self-defense, defense of third parties, consent, and so forth, when you're talking about the direct application of force against another individual. And they also realize that when you start talking about contracts, that contracts induced by fraud or by fundamental mistake may not be enforceable or might not be fully enforceable and so forth. But nonetheless, the classical libertarian finds it very difficult to move in those particular situations where there is perceived to be a breakdown in the way in which bargains are conducted, such that you're leaving money on the table. And what means by that is sometimes in order to get a cooperative result, you have to enlist the cooperation of multiple people. That then creates the opportunity that each one will hold out for a disproportionate share of the total, so that essentially the bargain never gets made. To give one example with respect to natural resources, the basic libertarian proposition holds true in this case, which means that the owners of the surface own the oil and gas that lies beneath it. But oil and gas pools tend to be much larger than farms. And if, in fact, you have non-cooperative behavior by a bunch of farmers or their lessees, oil companies, sticking wells into the pool, you can dissipate it. So what you need to do is to get an agreement amongst them so as to increase the output by reducing the number of wells that are, in fact, drilled. Now, when you start to do all of this, you do run into the holdout problem. And generally, it's kind of widely understood from bitter experience that the moment you get more than four or five surface owners, they can never come to agreement. They have different estimations of the facts, and they also play strategic games one to another. Enter the state, and what it does, in effect, is it creates some system of unitization, some system of division. Some of the wells are essentially capped, and then the greater output is divided by all the individuals who contribute to the common pool resource. So that's a classic case of bargaining breakdown for which a classical liberal is prepared to apply force, and to do so on the following principle. You may apply force against a given person in a holdout type situation where, when the system comes to its end, the party who's coerced to accept this compulsory system is left better off by its application than he was beforehand. In other words, if you increase the size of the pot very substantially, and in the case of oil and gas, it could be three and fourfold, essentially, even if you subtract out the administrative costs needed to put this in place, if you do it ideally, everybody's better off. So this means, in effect, that we have forced exchanges with a just compensation principle, which the libertarians don't like. This is not a small deviation, because what it does is it not only deals with common pool resources, it helps explain the logic behind the formation of the state, behind the logic for the application of a tax system, behind the logic for the application of a system of eminent domain, all of which, as you know, are beastly complicated.
Well, I want to take you through a couple of those. Let's start with the big one, which walk us back to the whole foundation of the state. I mean, when you have this debate about coercion and voluntary association, there is a stripe of these hardcore libertarians who want any sort of subordination to political authority to be voluntary. And the example that comes to mind here is Lysander Spooner, who famously wrote that he was not bound by the Constitution because he didn't sign it. And this at some level is an attractive idea. If I have ownership over myself, how can I be shanghaied into a political system that I never consented to? What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, the problem about Lysander is he's not the only one who can play that game. Every abolitionist may be able to play it, but every slaveholder may be able to play it. And essentially, if each individual is allowed to go his own way in accordance with his own lights, when people start to collide, each claiming self-defense and each being an aggressor, what you do is you can have anarchy and chaos. And so what you need to do is to have some system of governance. So the question then is, how long does it last? You put together a constitution, and ours is a pretty good example of how to do this right, with a couple of glaring exceptions. And then what you say is it only binds living people. Well, this is a constitution that lasts about a millisecond, because tomorrow somebody new is born, somebody old dies, and by 20 years you've had a complete turnover in a generation, and you cannot perpetually regenerate constitutions. If one looks at the way in which corporations, which are voluntary associations of work, they build in clauses which expressly contain that if you're a shareholder and you die, the shares, when they descend to your wife or to your ancestor or to your decedents, and not decedents, descendants in some shape or form, they're all bound by the original covenant. And one of the ways in which you try to figure out why you put together a constitution is you ask the way in which voluntary organizations like corporations work on questions of succession. And if they essentially have to reject, as they do, the Lysander Spooner principle, then you can say, look, this voluntary organization where things are formed consensually gives us a template which we can use to figure out how we form an organization. When it turns out there isn't a single owner of all things in society, property is diffuse, individuals have ownership over their own body. What we're doing in effect is putting them into a large system, and the Constitution is designed to make sure, to the extent that human institutions can do so, that each person, when subjected to this form of coercion, will be left at least as well off, if not better, than he was in the state of nature. And since the state of nature is pretty perilous, the gains that you could get from successful governance are very large, and he gets to share in them. So Lysander Spooner is essentially the quintessential virtuous holdout, and you cannot run a system of society if, in fact, all holdouts have to be induced by positive payment in order to come into the system. Sooner or later, either there's some degree of coercion to create a social contract, or the whole system falls apart.
You mentioned taxes earlier. There's a notion that you will hear from a certain stripe of libertarian, even a certain stripe of conservative, that all taxation is a form of theft. And you think this is the wrong approach for a classical liberal to take. Explain that.
Yes. Well, first of all, if all taxation is theft, then the level of taxes that's appropriate is zero, which means that you now have to rely on voluntary contributions to maintain a state, and everybody will hold out hoping that they can get the benefits of social order while contributing nothing to it. So the question is, why is this thing not to be regarded as theft? And the answer is, again, lies in the return benefit that individuals get by virtue of the peace and security that the government can create if its institutions are properly designed, with executive power separated from the legislature, with an independent set of courts, all the kinds of things that we think of in our own constitution, which are widely imitated elsewhere in the world. So if you ignore the benefit side of the equation, then in effect all coercion is simply like wild aggression. But think of it. I mean, taxation, when you run it correctly, is not like throwing people into jail and just leaving them there to rot. It essentially improves their lot. And the libertarians ignore the flip side and ignore the inability of somebody to create this situation by voluntary arrangements. Now, if you're a classical liberal, you respect the libertarian intuition that taxes are coercive and you got to watch them very carefully. So what you do is you try to limit the way in which they could be done so as to avoid the prospect that some people are taxed largely for the benefit of others. So the rhetoric of the president on the top 10%, on the top 1% being subject to special obligations and special duties, in effect, is as offensive to a classical liberal as it is to a libertarian. And indeed, if you go back to Aristotle or to Hayek or to Adam Smith or to my own work, and you're trying to figure out what classical liberals think, basically, they have very powerful prescriptions on how taxes are designed. They want them to be broad-based, preferably on consumption, but perhaps on income. They want them in general to be flat. And they don't want these things to be subject to all sorts of ad hoc exceptions of one kind or another. The classical liberal, therefore, can tell you what's wrong with the current tax system without saying, look, we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But the problem is that the hardline libertarian is now in this position where he says, since all taxes are theft, I can't distinguish amongst them. And it's the distinctions amongst them that mark the difference between a sensible and a nonsensible tax system. And it's precisely the inability to come to grips with this which makes the hardcore libertarian vulnerable to all sorts of political ridicule. You can't do that against the classical liberal, because he has very strong arguments as to why the progressivity that the president, for example, chances creates all sorts of inefficiency in production and all sorts of conflicts of interest among citizens that lead to a smaller pie, which ultimately redounds in a smaller share for everybody governed by the system.
Two areas where you talk about the traditional libertarian objections to government intervention in the economy being overbroad are the use of eminent domain and the regulation of anti-competitive behavior. But draw the lines for us here, because in both cases you're not saying the objections are fundamentally misplaced, just that they're too narrowly drawn.
Well, what I think is that it is a fundamental mistake to assume that any voluntary contract should be respected because it produces mutual gains to the parties. You always have to worry about external effects. The easy cases are always those in which two people conspire in order to murder a third. And now, in fact, the gains from trade between the two parties make them a greater threat to society than individuals acting alone, which is why it is that conspiracies to commit substantive offenses have always been a separate offense under the law. And a libertarian, I think, would not want to oppose that particular result. At least I hope not. Now, when you're dealing with the economic stuff, the creation of a monopoly, the creation of a cartel, essentially reduces output, raises prices, and by the standard economic analysis, produces a smaller pie than you had before. So if you could have a prohibition against these contracts, which doesn't apply to ordinary contracts for the sale of goods and services, essentially that prohibition will give you a larger pie from which everybody benefits. So it's against the same argument that you made before. The application of a very modest degree of force against a certain class of transactions, when done in the general case, approves the overall social welfare, not as some collective good, but essentially something that redounds to the benefit of individuals within the system. So even the libertarians, or many of them, say, you know, I don't like these contracts in restraint of trade. I won't enforce them. And that's a perfectly legitimate position, but it's a deviation from the hardline libertarian position, which essentially says we don't distinguish between different contracts by types. And once you concede that you don't have to enforce these horizontal arrangements, then there is no per se automatic argument which says that you can't subject them to civil or criminal sanctions. And indeed, cartels are very dangerous, and the reason why the progressives are so dangerous is far from fighting these cartels, starting from Roosevelt and going forward. What they did is they actually organized them and strengthened them at both the state and the federal level, both for unions and with respect to agriculture, with respect to exports. So again, what happens is the classical liberal on this point joins with the libertarian in opposing any kind of government arrangement which gives exclusive franchises to these individuals when there's no offsetting gain that follows, as is the case, which the libertarians, I think, are wrong about, with patents, at least if the patent system is correctly constructed.
The distinction I keep hearing you make seems to indicate that for a classical liberal, as opposed to a libertarian, individual liberty is not necessarily the highest good in each and every situation, but in most situations, the highest good does require individual liberty. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. Most people don't spend their lives making cartels. What they do is they spend their lives buying their houses, buying food, going to the market, taking jobs. In the standard situation in which you have bilateral contracts in a competitive market, the best thing the state can do is to make sure that these are not coercive transactions by duress, but not sit there trying to tell somebody, you know, we don't think it's right for you to work for any wage below X, so we're going to impose a minimum wage. And if you want to see where the classical liberal and the classical libertarian comes together, when you hear somebody like the president announcing, I don't like these contracts because they're substandard, I'm going to give you something better, that becomes to both of us a colossal form of impudence, where somebody who knows nothing about the utility function of the various people deigns to say that his particular solution is right and theirs is wrong. And what makes it so galling is he's probably wrong on the merits, because one of the things we know about the healthcare system is that it gives you a set of benefits that most people don't want, but it takes away from most people things they really do care, namely the choice of their own physician, so that you can keep your own doctor. Resonates so strongly in the popular mind because that which is lost, in fact, is valued very highly by the people who, by government of action, are forced to do it. So the reason why the classical liberal and the libertarian in popular view are often linked together is they are both very much against that kind of coercion which diminishes overall social welfare, because they don't supply to the people who coerce the benefits equal or greater to the losses that they've sustained. So the libertarian has a per se rule: we don't want you to force to do anything. The classical liberal has a different per se rule, which is the government may never force individuals into losing transactions. And over a very large class of cases, the two sides correspond, which is why it is we call them variations on a common theme rather than treating them as strict opponents, like you would say is the relationship between the classical liberal on the one hand and the progressive on the other.
So, final question. As you know, there's a lot of pessimism going around these days for people who believe in limited government. And part of the excitement that is generated by a guy like Rand Paul, even if you may differ with him on some of the specifics, is that you've actually got a guy out there beating the drum for this stuff. And there's two ways to look at that. One is to say it's a hopeful sign to have someone like that emerge as a national figure. It might be a leading indicator that the winds are changing. The other is to say it's one guy in a reliably Republican state, in a country that has otherwise twice elected Barack Obama and therefore is less responsive than ever to the principles of classical liberalism. How optimistic or pessimistic are you that those principles will once again have some purchase with the American people and therefore in government in the near future?
Look, it's a very strange position to be yoked, at least in some ways, with somebody like Rand Paul. And it's quite clear, for example, if you talk about the piece in the New York Times dealing with Rand Paul's mixed inheritance, that its authors, in effect, are designed quite consciously, that is Sam Tannenhouse and Jim Ruttenberg, to tar every version of small government guy with the Bertha kind of epithet that he uses in that case. I think that's indefensible for people to write like that, and I think it's a real slur to Rand Paul and to everybody. But even if you put aside those things, the danger that I have with somebody like Paul is he starts talking about smaller government. And then somebody says, well, tell me, smaller government doesn't mean zero government, Senator Paul. What does it mean? What can the state do? And if you take a deep suspicion with respect to the antitrust laws, with respect to pooling arrangements, with respect to taxes, with respect to eminent domain, if you start to think that every public street has to be privately owned, what's going to happen is you're going to expose the movement to ridicule. You can't do that to the classical liberal, because his basic position, of course we have taxation, but we're going to bind it. I'm going to tell you how. And you can't say the same thing with respect to the antitrust law. And then if you go back to our constitutional tradition and put aside all of the disgraceful behavior with slavery and segregation, both of which are, by the way, nothing whatsoever to do with classical liberal positions, the strength of the American Constitution lies in the fact that over a very broad area of activities, the judges prior to the New Deal collapse in 1937 actually got the system more or less correct. So not only have I written my book, The Classical Liberal Constitution, but I recently wrote a history of rate regulation before 1937, and I'm writing now another history of antitrust enforcement before 1937. And these activities by the earlier courts show a tremendous degree of intuitive sophistication, even though the formal apparatus that we use as a matter of, quote, social welfare theory to evaluate these arrangements was largely unknown to them. And so what you try to do, and what I urge Mr. Paul to do, is to look at the classical liberal version, see whether or not it's something that he could find tenable. If it is, then he doesn't have to go forward as on domestic issues as a hardcore libertarian. He can say, even if you accept all of the legitimate functions that government has in the areas just mentioned, eminent domain, taxation, preservation of common resource, environmental law, and so forth, you still have a very powerful and pronounced and viable alternative to the modern progressive state, which believes that expertise can overcome conflicts of interest, that property rights are essentially an unneeded extra, and that this massive system of government regulation, which has led to the stagnation of the last 5 or 6 years, offers us the only way out of the abyss. And that's just not true. And so I think he can switch stars, become a little bit more sophisticated on these things, and take a position that gives him 90% of what he wants and gets rid of 90% of the kind of silly objections that people like Tannenhaus and Ruttenberg raise against the libertarian movement.
All right, Richard, thank you as always, and thanks to our listeners as well. Remember, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org. You can buy his aforementioned book, The Classical Liberal Constitution, The Uncertain Quest for Limited Government, and you can follow him on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a production of the Hoover Institution. Thank you for listening.